Hello, and welcome to The Dirt, a podcast about archaeology, anthropology, and our shared human past. I'm Anna.
And I'm Amber. And it is so great to be here in Anna's office with Anna's dog making weird mouth sounds. And it's so great to be here specifically and not on a plane back to Saudi Arabia. I'm here after an unplanned hiatus with... I had a lot of work travel, a lot of work trips, and it says, the work trip from hell that Anna wrote for me. I had a bit of I descended to Hades and came back, which is what I call being on travel status, but I'm still recovering, still working on my expense report, but I'm here.
I'm glad you're here,
buddy. I'm here.
great news. We didn't have to work hard at all to come up with this episode topic because it's a sponsored one.
Oh.
So many thanks to Adrian, who slipped us a cheeky $25 via PayPal and wrote this, quote, over the pandemic. Long story.
It was really pandemic.
It was a long story. I started to really specialize in reproducing knit hats, specifically 18th century, found in naval archaeological contexts. Including the Gajana Barrette, the De Brock hat, the Brunswick town hat, the General Carlton hat.
Amazing. Amazing.
I'm still quoting. I would love an episode on textiles, really, knit naval hats,
what?
But I'm open, and how underwater archaeology affects them, preservation,
what?
Dyes, etc., and maybe specific details about some interesting finds, end quote.
What?
And we're seeing this for the first time. So
this is amazing.
So Adrian works in museum stuff and is a living history hobbyist.
Ah!
So textiles of interest.
Oh, and wow.
Specifically like knitting replica hats. I want one.
Oh. Oh, wow. Well, as I told Anna when I opened the script, I'm about to cry because this is just so nice. It's so nice to like open up an email and see something nice. but this is why we love sponsor episodes. I literally would have never thought of this.
No.
If you gave
me neither.
All the time in the universe.
A million monkeys on a million typewriters.
Yeah, would not have generated this lovely PayPal note from Adrian. And also, we love this because we, for sure, need the money if we're going to keep making the show. But mostly, we love these because we probably would have never come up with something so specific and so intriguing. But now we, and specifically me, and I guess also specifically you, people who aren't Anna, get to learn about it. Because Anna already learned about it.
Well, the thing is right now that my computer says it's not connected to the internet, so I can't scroll. Would love to. Oh, here we go. There we are. Okay. Great. I'm going to leave that in because, frankly... I won't be editing this one very much, not just because today is my birthday.
Happy birthday, Anna.
Thank you.
All of my Duolingo lessons have been about a party for someone named Anna.
Oh, it's me. It's my party.
Like,
I don't want that owl to show
dang.
Up.
Like, all of these fictional characters have gotten their gifts for Anna, and I'm still working on it from 2 years ago.
I don't need gifts.
Good.
Yeah, that's great. I do want to, there is a sidebar here. Just because as I was writing this script, I was kind of, it was early in the morning and I had not, my brain had not fully powered up yet. And so I was sitting across from Naomi just going, what's the word that means, like I wanted the word intriguing.
Mm.
I could, but I was like reaching for it and I just could not find the word. It's like, it's interesting, but like
it,
in an
like,
unexpected way. And so, like, now we were both like, thesaurus.com, do, do, do. And then we was like, you know what's on this list? Amazeballs.
No.
It's a synonym for intriguing.
Oh.
Kinda.
Oh.
Anyway, we got to amazeballs.
Like,
that wasn't
the
word. It wasn't the word I was looking for, but it was funny. Okay. So, we're learning about hats. Historical ones, and also some tangentially related things, because when I don't know anything about a topic, like this one, I just kind of go where the research takes me. So here's what we're going to do.
Is the research what you call the algorithmically generated, you may also like blinks on the side?
No, I'm going to push back on that a little bit. No, I do.
What do you mean by the research?
I just start with articles about the thing that are from sources that I trust, and then I look in the sources of those sources. Mm. So it's not algorithmically generated, but it is like a similar stepping stone.
Bibliometrically generated. Doing a little bit of bibliometrics.
I'm going to keep reading the script. Okay. Here's what we're going to do. Adrian mentioned 4 types of hats. I found information on 3 of them. Adrian, if you are listening, I'm sorry. I hope 3 out of 4 is okay. I did my best. It's my birthday. So we're going to do a brief rundown on the history of those and sort of why they're called what they're called. Spoiler, shipwrecks. And then get into some of the science of textiles and their preservation. We might be talking about knit hats in general because wasn't aware that there was so much to know about the knit cap. But here we are with a whole episode.
Yeah.
And we'll get to preservation in underwater contexts. And then we will get to interesting finds, which I am totally sure Adrian specifically meant as archaeological finds, but which I choose to interpret also as cool related things I found while researching. So there's our roadmap.
This isn't like your recent Facebook Marketplace haul or anything. Interesting finds. This ottoman shaped like a cow.
That Amber was a Facebook Marketplace.
I know, but
I do have an ottoman shaped like a cow, and I love it very much. Amber's feet are currently on.
As seen on Facebook Marketplace.
As seen on.
Amazing.
Yeah, so there's our, I said roadmap, but it's really a nautical map.
Oh!
We're spending time.
Oh no.
At sea. Oh. But our ears are warm.
Because our ears are warm because we've got a knit cap. I got my little bands on, little pressure points so I don't barf.
No barfy bands? Yeah.
The various hats we'll be talking about are iterations on the classic knit cap, or beanie, or toque, which Anna has helpfully written as...
No, it's both. It's toque.
Toque and toque?
Yeah, we'll get into it.
The toque toque. Uh-huh. Is it toque? Toque is French? They say it in French?
Well, they also say it in French Canadian.
Yeah, well, that, I mean...
We'll get there!
Okay, well, I just recently learned this because some French people were talking.
Well, the thing is, toque is the French word.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Toque is the French, I believe it is the French Canadian.
Ah. But...
They do their vowels different.
I don't... Oh, I'm losing my mind. Somebody was speaking to me in French or something, and they said something about a hat.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
But that was when I was like, oh. So I had my own journey of discovery recently at some point when I was sitting on my couch in the last week. Or toboggan or watch cap, depending on where you're from.
Although I will say the toboggan specifically is the knit cap with the little ear flaps that come down that you can tie under your chin to keep your ears warm. Oh. Extra.
Have you let my mom know?
What? That she needs flaps on her hat?
Well, that I'm sure my mother would love to be corrected. I'm like, let's get your toboggan. I'd be like, it's not a toboggan, it's a knit cap.
Does she call it a toboggan?
She calls it a toboggan.
Aww.
It's very cute.
That's very cute.
The earliest documentation of this kind of hat comes from 15th century Wales.
The country of Wales, not not the undersea mammal.
They got ears on the inside. Right? They got ears, right?
Yes, whales have ears.
I just was checking.
But it would be hard to put a cap on a whale. No cap.
This is the part where we remind you that the earliest record of something isn't the same as the earliest occurrence of something. Hats are probably old. But in the 15th and 16th century CE in Wales, the knit cap really had its moment. Time for some hat story.
Thank you.
So, quoting here from Atlas Obscura. Quote, the modern knit hat appears to trace its origins to the Welsh town of Monmouth That's where Joffrey is from.
Yes, Joffrey of Monmouth.
Whose proximity to Archenfield, a popular wool-producing town, made it a natural knitting hub.
You know, a natural knitting hub. Those hubs of knitting all know.
Yeah, so they had a little startup incubator. They had a little vertically integrated. They were really,
Disrupting the sheep industry.
Yeah. Sorry to break this quote up with a little work anecdote. A thing that's happening for work right now at this very moment. The venue is like one of those WeWorky makerspace kind of things.
Yeah, a shared workplace.
And we had we have a contract with them, and so they gave us the contract, and I gave it to my contracts officer, and she gave it back with several highlights, and she's like, why do they keep referring to this as an incubator?
Where are the eggs?
And she's just like, what is it? I thought this was a venue. And I'm just like, no,
it's just a place where ideas cook.
Yeah, so it's just the best feedback I've ever gotten on a contract.
What is like, this? This word is stupid.
Why do they keep saying this word? But.
So Monmouth.
Monmouth's most beloved knitted product. A round hat topped with a button.
I don't think it was the kind of button that you button a shirt with, but I think it was just like a little nubbin.
A little poof.
It might have been a pom-pom. It might have just been like a knitted, a little
sheet. During the 15th and 16th centuries CE, the Monmouth cap achieved ubiquity throughout Europe. According to a short history of the Monmouth cap,
which is a manuscript that exists.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Quote, cap making so flourished under the Tudors that cappers came to occupy such municipal posts as bailiff, burgess, and juror. End quote. Hats off to them.
Hey.
So the Tudors I see in the notes that Anna gave me specifically is Henry VIII. Queen Elizabeth and Shakespeare times, I thought she just died.
The first one died in the 1500s.
Which one is this one?
Two.
There was Queen Elizabeth. They waited that long for a sequel?
It was much anticipated, I'm sure. Yeah, like, you know, the boat, the QE2, Queen Elizabeth II. That's that one. The Queen Mama.
What's that boat? What's that boat?
It was a big ocean liner.
Why would I know that? Did it sink?
I don't think
so. Was it fast?
No.
In fact, a 1571 English statute required that, quote, all males above the age of 6 years wear upon the Sabbath and holy days one cap of wool knit, thicked and dressed in England, end quote. While non-noble wives, quote, were constrained to wear white knit caps of woolen yarn, end quote.
Telling them what hats to wear.
And they have to be, like, made in England hats.
That's a very specific thing that Queen Elizabeth I was actually really savvy at doing, was, like, controlling English markets by making certain English products mandatory in some way.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know much about it, but I remember... As I was writing this, I was like, that rings a bell. She did something with, like, the National Lottery and the Spanish Armada.
Wouldn't have been a fan of NAFTA, that one.
Probably not.
Ugh.
No.
So that was a classic, like, she, big fan of a lot of, like, mid-aughts country music.
Sure.
Just, like, what things made in England. By 1576... The Welsh hats were so popular that they officially had their own name. In a letter dated to that year, Lord Gilbert Talbot of Goodrich Castle gifted his father a Monmouth cape.
Yes, C-A-P-P-E. Yeah.
End.
End quote.
Just gonna walk out.
Yeah.
That is.
I love that someone tracked that down.
That I thank you, author of a short. History of
the Monmouth
Kappa.
Yeah. I don't know if you can tell, but that's it's an old treatise that particular one.
It's a treatise.
So I don't know how it was spelled. I don't know how the
but like
yeah. Yeah. Okay, so around the same time, Shakespeare times, also in Europe, you get the toque, which was a more structured cylindrical hat. The predecessor, I mean cylindrical but with a top. It wasn't just a tube on your head.
It's like one of those like those Dr. Seuss like the freak like raver hats.
No. But a little. Imagine the classic chef's hat.
Uh-huh.
Like,
I am.
Like the Swedish chef.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's he wearing? It's a toque.
Okay.
To your left. To your right. Everybody's wearing a toque. You're all chefs. The name toque or toque probably comes from Breton, the Celtic or Breton, the Celtic language spoken. Oh my god. The Celtic language is spoken in Bretagne, in northern France. So the English brought the knit cap to North America, specifically first to Jamestown in the 1620s, and the French brought the toque slightly more northward, roughly the modern French-Canadian region today.
Like, so, to Cape Breton?
Hey, that makes sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The shape was also something that fur traders really took to it. And that's where you get that, like, tall beaver fur hat that you can picture on a trapper.
Yeah.
On the St. Lawrence River. Is that just me?
Nope. Oh. I got it.
Great.
Right there.
All
right.
So, Amber, I'm going to read to you here from a 2017, but updated in 2023, article from Heddles, which is an anti-fast fashion online journal.
What?
I made sure to poke around to check for red flags, but I think it's sort of like Sapiens, but for environmentally minded people interested in fashion and history. So that'll be linked in the show notes, but it's a cool site. There's lots of interesting articles on there.
Wow. This is, I think we used to call these blogs.
Yeah, it's a blog, but with lots of different authors. So it's like a blog.
A blog collective?
Amalgam blog.
Oh my gosh.
A blog amalgam.
I remember these.
Oh my god. Okay, so it's obviously not an unbiased article because like there's a heavy slant of like vintage is good, reuse, recycle, upcycle. Yeah. But I don't think that bias really applies to this specific case. So it was just a historical article about hats, knit caps. So the article starts by mentioning the Monmouth cap and another example from Norway, but then makes the very salient point that, hey, people probably figured out similar ways to keep their heads warm in different cold places.
Oh, yeah?
Right?
Like, I wear my cat.
Mm. She just is a non-voluntary hat situation.
Oh, sometimes it's extremely voluntary.
Oh, okay.
Like when I'm in a meeting.
Oh, wow.
And she's like,
No, I meant... You don't get to choose when you are wearing your cat hat.
Other times I choose.
Okay.
No, it's never mutually consensual.
Great. The perfect relationship. So quoting from that Heddles article, quote, if one is to believe the cap originated in either Great Britain or Scandinavia, it makes sense that it would be associated with durable, practical workwear. But could the answer be buried even further in the past? Yes. So, continuing the quote.
Nice!
Yeah, bro.
One of my favorite caps!
I know! It's a special surprise for you.
Thank you!
Continuing the quote. The Phrygian cap has its origins in the Hellenistic period and would come to be worn by freed slaves in ancient Rome. The powerful classical symbolism inherent in this rather silly hat would not be lost on history, and in the late 1600s, they would be called bonnet rouge and worn by revolutionaries in an early anti-nobility revolt that served as a precursor to the French Revolution.
Nice.
The United States Capitol Rotunda, so the painting thereupon, features a Liberty cap, which is basically a little Phrygian Smurf hat.
Oh, yeah!
On the head of a woman on George Washington's right, on George Washington's right in The Apotheosis of George Washington.
I thought he just died.
He
did. I didn't know he got...
I mean, after the fact, I think
I didn't know
people sanctified him. Yeah,
heaven.
No, he just got bled to death by doctors who were like, "This'll work." I'm still quoting. Not that. That wasn't me quoting. This is now. American artist Thomas U. Davis tried many times to include Liberty caps throughout the famous works of art in the American Capitol, but was often denied, end quote, because it had too much, like, anti-slavery symbolism.
Oh, yeah, we don't want that.
No, don't want that. Also, in that particular painting that I just mentioned, George Washington really looks like Beethoven.
And that lady really looks like me in every candid photo
of me. You've just had it. So, to talk about our first knitted artifact from Hatstory, we need to visit a shipwreck. So, the Gaggiana set sail from Venice in 1583, packed with European luxury goods, bound for the court of Sultan Murad III, the Ottoman ruler at the time.
Oh.
Yeah. So this is from an Art News article. Quote, "The trove of recovered artifacts made in cities including Venice, Vienna, Berlin, Nuremberg, and Lübeck includes chandeliers, thousands of wine glasses, beads, leather-framed spectacles, and a miraculously preserved 170-foot length of embroidered silk, along with hundreds of cannons and cannonballs. It was a bulk order destined for the Ottoman Sultan, Murad III, who was building a palatial new home for his harem." End quote. So the ship never reached its destination, but sank under mysterious circumstances off the coast of Croatia. The circumstances being they mixed up their wets and their dries. So off the coast of Croatia, and allegedly it is a case of fraud at sea.
Oh, snap!
Fraud?
Like, throwback to that time I told you about
fraud at sea.
Bottomage,
which both of them sound silly. But those are the words. Yeah. So, for listeners who aren't familiar with the silly words we just said,
go listen to that episode.
Come back.
Thank you.
The practice of insuring your ship for a lot and then purposely scuttling the ship and collecting the insurance. So, part of the legend. So, the ship's high value cargo was insured, and there's a lot of the paperwork from it that survives somehow in archives in Venice. Just, how are they not waterlogged?
You know, like, I get that I've spent a non-zero amount of my life reading things that are like 3,000 years old. But this kind of stuff blows my mind.
Why is that?
How'd you not lose it?
Oh.
Like, do you know how many pairs of glasses are somewhere in my apartment?
I think probably the interior of the Venetian Glassmakers Guild archive is a little more organized than where you keep your glasses.
How dare you?
Speculating. I'm speculating. Part of the legend is that there was one set of diamonds registered on board, and another apparently on board, but not registered. So the captain supposedly sank the ship on purpose. Possibly
two sets? Two sets of diamonds?
Two sets of diamonds, but only paperwork for one. So conveniently, free and clear set of diamonds.
I don't know. Just steal them.
Allegedly.
You don't have to. Okay.
Allegedly.
Sorry to Monday morning quarterback this.
So the captain supposedly sank the ship on purpose and scampered off with the diamonds, but there's no actual proof.
Wow.
So, getting to the part about the hats. Part of the cargo that was recovered from the wreck in the 1960s was a wooden chest with iron fittings. The wood rotted away, but everything was still preserved. Which contained 3 men's linen shirts, 54 meters of silk damask, so that's the 107, however many yards of... Anyway. And 8 men's knitted hats.
So, wood chest, no wood.
But it had iron fittings.
So, like, but wood chest, no wood, other organic materials inside.
They were protected enough that as the wood rotted around them, they kind of got covered with sediment enough that they themselves weren't. And because the bottom of the ocean, not a lot of oxygen, that helped with the preservation. And the iron
made it. Yeah, I guess it's just like that the wood, all of what you just said makes it sound like the wood wouldn't have rotted either.
Well, it did.
No, I'm saying like.
Yeah. I'm not sure.
How'd that work?
Well, for one thing, because of the iron fittings of that chest, the hats that were sitting in it were impregnated with rust.
Oh.
Since they...
Congratulations.
Happy, healthy, bouncing baby hat. So conservators worked to clean off the rust, and as they did so, they recorded the measurements of the hat and the basic method used to knit it. So if you, listener, are a fiber arts kind of person and you'd like to have a crack at making one of these, the show notes will include a link to a pattern,
what?
Plus a blog post on how the creator of the pattern based it on the conservator's notes for the original Gajana caps.
Are we confident that this wasn't written by listener Adrian?
The name listed on the post was not Adrian. So
perhaps Adrian is a curious frau.
Well,
isn't that the link?
It is, yeah. Yeah, Curious Frau is the blog poster, but I remember seeing that person's actual name somewhere else, and it was not Adrian. Okay.
Also aboard the Gajana were glass beads from Murano, Italy. And that's something for our upcoming episode on glass. Because, wow, there is a surprising amount of intrigue and drama there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I look forward to our upcoming episode on glass.
Surprise!
I'm not supposed to write it, right?
No, I'm writing it.
Okay, great.
Eventually.
Okay, that would have been a surprising amount of intrigue and drama if I found out that...
No, it's
guess
a
what?
Me.
You're late. But for now, we move on to a different shipwreck. The De Brack.
Yep.
Despite the very Dutch name, the De Brack was a sloop... Oh, come on. Was a sloop in the British Royal Fleet.
Because...
What is sloop?
It's a two-masted sailing ship.
So what is a one-masted one called? Slop?
I think...
See what I did there?
I did.
Thank you. In May of 1798, the ship encountered a sudden, intense storm, something called a microblast, apparently, and was slammed against the coast.
I wanted to say the... Was weighing in. Not a fan of a duchess?
She doesn't like storms.
She's like, no, I'm sloopy. Don't wake me up, I'm too sloopy. No, the De Brack was a Dutch ship, but was captured. There was some war between the Dutch and the British captured the ship, because that's how rules of engagement worked, I guess.
And they didn't
rename
it?
And they were like,
this
is mine now.
Dems De Bracks.
Dems De Bracks. Please continue.
From a 2012 article from Delaware Public Media, the leading authority on
Dutch
sloops. Quote, from July to September in 1798, the British tried to raise the ship but failed. They weren't the only ones.
You raise me up.
In the next 100 years, other touted efforts were equally unsuccessful. The ship seemingly disappeared. In 1984, Reno, Nevada-based Subsal saw a treasure to rival the motherlode found on a Florida
shortcake?
A Florida wreck. De Brack fit the bill. The company used side-scan sonar to find a wreck off Delaware's coast. Divers brought up a ring with an inscription that belonged to the ship's captain, confirming the find as the De Brack. So it went Delaware?
Oh, De Brack is Dutch for the beagle.
Cute.
In 1798, the De Brack was ordered to sail across the Atlantic as an armed guard for a convoy of merchant ships, which were at risk in those days from pirates and the French Navy. Privateer stuff.
Oh, dang. I'm looking at De Brack.
Mm-hmm.
On the Delaware.gov.
Huh.
Okay. Well.
Yeah. So it was there escorting.
It was there on business.
On business.
Okay.
And it certainly wasn't a pleasure.
The two-year salvage effort yielded footwear, toothbrushes, cannonballs, and barrel pieces. There's pottery, a sailor's wool hat.
Hat?
a tea set, 16 cannons, muskets, pistols, and salt cellars. There is a bottle bearing the word ketchup, a makeshift sauce used to disguise the taste of salt-preserved food.
As it is today.
In short, there is much to do with the everyday life of those aboard an 18th century warship.
Yeah, not warship. Warship. Yeah, so there's that a picture. Wool hat. Yeah, there's a picture in the script of the wool hat that was preserved and brought up from the Dubrock wreck. It's a little, speaking of the Dr. Seuss Raver hats, it's a little more shaped like that.
It's got a little volume up there, so it looks like it would go down, like, keep your neck warm around your ears.
I can't tell if that's a brim or if that's...
Oh.
Or I think it's knitted as a brim because it's wider than the tube. So I think it's kind of like it would be floppy but then have a brim around it to keep spray off of your face.
So it would go all the way around the front.
I think so.
For a 34-page article on how textiles are preserved after being removed from shipwrecks, you too can check out the link to a Queen Anne's Revenge Project publication that will be in the show notes.
Yeah, so Blackbeard's ship, the Queen Anne's Revenge, is a whole institution unto itself and produces documents, and one of them is this sort of guide to conservation of textiles at sea. So the article...
Well, from sea, not... Yeah, yeah. Not doing...
yeah, after sea.
Doing extreme conservation.
Yeah, there was only one little section on rust removal,
mm-hmm.
And it didn't specifically talk about wool. It talked about linen, cotton, and hemp, which are also just like all over the place on sailing ships of that era. Mm-hmm. So can't help you much with wool, but it is very interesting.
Hmm. Yeah. Basically, rust removal involves soaking textiles in a diluted acid solution to dissolve away the rust without damaging the fibers.
Yeah, they did a cool experimental archaeology where it was like, here are swatches of rusty cloth.
I was going to make a joke about how you just, like, put it, you, like, keep changing the contents of the bucket, but apparently that's what you do.
Yes.
This is all I know about conservation. Yeah. So just, like,
you just gotta rinse it
up. Put in a new bucket.
Yeah. Yeah.
You all do amazing work. You put it in a bucket.
Yeah. A series of buckets.
That's why the Getty Institute is so big. It's like, you gotta keep all those buckets in there. I was there recently.
Okay. So the other method for preserving textiles from shipwrecks involves freezing the material and then allowing it to slowly dry while still in the frozen state. So freeze drying, but not flash freezing, like the kind that gets you your freeze-dried strawberries. So our last hat, I think, personally, is the cutest one, is the General Carleton hat. And guess what? It's from a shipwreck.
It is cute.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's got a fun little pattern.
Yeah, and it's got a woolen fringe at the bottom and a little woolen tuffy.
Is that a woolen fringe or is that fur?
I guess it could be fur. Hard to tell. Okay, so the General Carleton was a ship.
Oh, it wasn't a guy.
It was named after a guy, but
in
this case it was the ship.
Okay.
The ship sank in 1785 off the coast of Poland on a trade route between Britain and the Baltic region. The ship was loaded with iron and tar as cargo when she sank, and the wreck was found in 1995. We will have links in the show notes to the site report from at least part of the recovery team.
This just in. Poland is on the coast.
It has a coast, yeah. It has a coastline.
Look at that.
Otherwise, otherwise, the folks at the Polish Maritime Museum would be.
Look at that map.
Wow.
There's a whole lot of coast.
Yeah.
Oh, dang. I'm sorry, everyone.
Over 775 artifacts were raised and preserved by the Polish Maritime Museum in an excavation led by Dr. Waldemar Osowski. Many of these were knitted items of clothing, some possibly manufactured in the Baltic, but most, no doubt, from Yorkshire.
Oh!
Sponsored by Big Yorkshire. those barrels of pine tar that I mentioned, in the cargo hold, had been smashed up during the wreck, and the tar mixed with the sand and water to form a matrix, and that preserved the artifacts that it covered, which included clothing and even paper.
Amazing.
Yeah, no, not jealous of the conservator who had to remove tar from paper.
Swap out those buckets.
Just so many buckets. Items of clothing included sailors' jackets, waistcoats, shoes, stockings, and hats.
Incredible.
Waistcoats. The General Carleton wasn't a Royal Navy vessel, but an armed merchantman, so sailors wouldn't have been in uniform. They'd be wearing their own clothes that they bought.
Oh.
So that's, so the clothes on board are representative of, like, their outfits.
Just usual business casual.
Yes. Looks. Their OOTD. Outfit on the deck.
Oh.
Some of these. Oh, God. Some of these clothes even survived on the seabed, still neatly folded, because they'd been stored in slop chests, not to be confused with sloop chests, that had rotted away around them. Slops was the generic name for sailors' clothing.
Oh.
You put your slops in the chest.
Yeah. Yeah, and now, after I...
You've learned so much.
After I...
It's such a short time.
I was thinking, hungry, this whole time. Which isn't on the coast. I know that.
Okay.
I know where places are. And finally, a quick little roundup. As requested, some interesting examples of textile preservation.
Although I realized as I was writing it that in this first example, it's like preserved impression of textile, but the textile itself is not preserved. So.
Oh, cool. Well, this comes to us from one of my... all-time favorite museums, truly.
Yeah.
I passed out in it once in the preserved bird section.
I know, it's good.
Well, no, I was ill.
And I'm sorry.
A little baby faint. Aww. I fainted. And I woke up and there were all these dead birds staring at me.
Wow.
Amazing. Carnegie Museum of Natural History in the big city, Pittsburgh. quote, working in the eastern United States, it's hard to find archaeological textiles. The very world is against it.
Yep. That's how they worded that.
What eastern archaeologists find is a lot of pottery, and luckily for us, much of it has been impressed with cordage. cordage, or fabric.
Impressed, like the pasta.
As part of the pottery making process, clay coils were consolidated by being beaten with a wooden paddle, a tool frequently wrapped with cordage or fabric. This technique may have initially developed to create decoration, but the resulting roughened surface also made for a better grip, and the increased surface area caused pots to heat quicker in cooking.
Yeah, I made that same face when I was reading that. I was like, oh,
It would do that. It would do that. Archaeologists study the long vanished textiles by making durable impressions of pottery surfaces with modeling clay or dental impression material. The information revealed through the thorough study of such impressions is not limited to the determination of just what type of cord or textile was used in making the original object.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then, do you want me to just like imagine? Yeah,
I want you to click on the link.
Okay. There.
And so
next we have cool hairnet thingy from Denmark.
Yeah, but it is really cool. So this is from the Denmark Museum of Natural History, I believe.
Well, it's not.
But there on this page it says, quote, Denmark possesses one of the largest collections of prehistoric textiles in the world. This is particularly due to unique preservation conditions encountered in the Bronze Age burial mounds and in the peat bogs. We love a peat bog. Where early Iron Age skin and textiles have been discovered. So yeah, this is a head covering.
This one is an early Bronze Age head covering from the Borum Issue. Near Aarhus.
Where you've been?
I've been there.
You've been there. You've been in that bog.
I haven't been in the bog. I didn't get in the bog.
Yeah. So we
still
can...
Still be in the bog.
We can... listeners, you can see this too, because the link will be in the show notes, but it's really cool.
It's sprang.
Sprung?
Oh.
Maybe? I think that's... think this one's made out of, or the style. I'm not sure. Well, this last one that I have blew my mind.
Oh, okay.
It is so cool.
What?
So this is from a site in what is today Pakistan. Nowsharo is the site. But this is a fragment of textile that essentially was fossilized. Like, it was mineralized because it happened to be resting on a piece of copper plate. And I think what happened was that the copper leached out over time. And this textile is 4,000 years old. And it's this little bitty piece, but you can see, it's like 20 millimeters by 20. It's like a little square. It's kind of perfectly preserved.
What?
Looks sort of like burlap sacking material.
Yeah.
So I'm going to quote from the research publication.
This is some Indus Valley civilization site.
Uh-huh.
In Baluchistan.
Yeah. So this phenomenon, referred to as mineralization, had already been observed even in conditions that were highly detrimental to the preservation of organic matter. And so, like, this was known by at least the 18th century that this could happen. But as you might imagine, it's kind of rare. So,
Is this something that's ever been done intentionally?
I don't
think... Is there a purpose? Is there any applications for it?
Not that I'm aware of. No, I think it's just a kind of a unique preservation circumstance that happens sometimes.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty rare. As early as the 19th century, archaeologists excavating major sites in the Middle East were surprised by the existence of a number of identifiable textile imprints found petrified on the surface of objects, often metallic. So, if you have cloth and metal interacting in the right conditions, maybe you get little cloth fossils.
Amazing.
Cloths.
Nope. Wow.
Would you say that these made an impression?
Oh, they sure did.
Well, good, because that's what
impressed.
I got. That's what I got. You're
an
impressed clay.
Aw. Thank you. Thanks, Adrian.
Yeah, this
was, really made my day.
Truly, like, thank you. This was so fun to research. I went into it going, oh no, I know nothing. I can't even knit.
I can't either.
I know what a hat is.
I love wearing them.
Not
so much.
But
I got a big head.
Who knew that I could wring so much out of 3 nautical hats? I just had a great time. We would never, never, never have thought of this topic. And
no.
So, what a treat.
What a fun hobby.
Yeah. Yeah, we'd love to get in touch, Adrian. We'd love to see examples
Show
of your work.
Hats.
If you're willing to. I think that's going to do it for this episode.
Yeah.
And
thanks, everybody. Thanks for your patience with me while I went hither and yon. And
mostly yon.
I went so far away.
Yeah.
But while I was so far away, I met some cool people doing cool stuff. And
specifically archaeological. And
Yeah. Doing stuff in the heritage space.
Yeah.
Cool people all over this great nation and in other nations. I mean, they're great too. But just like...
and other nations that are also good.
Yeah. No. Maybe you may be hearing more about some of those people and places in the months to come. And great news, I'm going back to school.
Woo!
And so
we'll have a schedule again.
We absolutely will, and I am so jazzed.
Yeah, and so listeners, in the meantime, to help us keep the show going, we really do plead, encourage, and implore you to sign up for our Captivate Premium feed. There's lots of bonus material in it for you, and for us, it allows us to keep the show on, I was going to say on the airwaves, but
it's still going to go.
On the internet.
Yeah, and so if you were a supporter of us on Patreon, please remember that you can join the Legacy feed, which is...
It's $3.99 for you.
At which, and some people have been paying for it, or they've been sending us tips, and it's just so nice.
Thank you so much. I didn't mean to make it sound like we hadn't had anybody sign up. We have had several,
plenty of folks. Really, really great.
And it's so wonderful. We are just, every time we get that little email from Captivate, it's so nice.
So nice.
Real nice. But yeah, if you like the show, you want more of the show, or you want the show to keep going, this is rare to pair. Listen, with these dulcet tones and my diction, who could resist? But thank you, everyone who has signed up.
And I'm also here.
And Amber is also here. And it's good to co-host with the mo-host.
Well, happy birthday, Anna.
Thanks.
Happy day, listener.
Happy my birthday to all of you.
Yeah.
If you have the opportunity and the desire, have some cake. Have a treat. That would make me happy.
All right. Take care of yourselves, everyone.
We love you. Bye.
Goodbye.